FM weather with Liberty Insurance. Car insurance up for renewal in the next 30 days? Visit libertyinsurance.ie to find out why we are different.
Mainly clear from the west this evening, extending southeast. Lowest temperatures later of 9 to 12 degrees.
Game on, weeknights from 6.
On 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to the two Johnnies for the afternoon entertainment. It is Wednesday, September 13th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, John Fallon of the Irish Examiner, I should say, will have the latest on FAI managerial uncertainty, grassroots GDPR issues and what to expect from tomorrow's briefing in Abbottstown. Michael Corcoran has the latest from the Irish Rugby Camp as we edge closer to Saturday's Tongan Test. And with some big news in the NFL, Jeff Shepherd will be dialing in a day early with his eye on America. If you want to have your say, send us a text 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there, good evening, great to have your company on 2FM on this Wednesday evening. Before we get into our chat, just one news headline outstanding this evening, and that is the Irish Athletic Boxing Association has settled an employment rights dispute with its former high performance director Bernard Dunn. The deal was reached after last minute talks at the Workplace Relations Commission's headquarters, where a public hearing into a statutory complaint by the former super bantamweight champion was set to open this afternoon. There are some rugby headlines, but we'll be getting into that shortly with Michael Corcoran. But first, John Fallon of the Irish Examiner, I've said it right this time, is in studio. John, how's the form?
I'm good, Shane, how are you?
All good. In good form, considering you were down in Turner's Cross last night watching Jim Crawford's under-21s make it 2 wins from 2 in their qualifying campaign?
Yes, it was good to have covering an Ireland team winning a game after being in Paris and in Lansdowne on Sunday. So actually got to catch the end of the Turkey game on Friday when I got back from Paris, where they came from behind twice to win 3-2. Last night, you know, bear in mind they are playing San Marino, so there's only so much really credence you can attach to it. But very impressive, they did the job. Rocco Vatta got 2 goals in the first half, and then Sinclair Armstrong, who'd come back for the senior squad, having made his debut on Sunday, he got a deserved 3rd one. And they did the job. That's 6 points from Turkey and San Marino, and they have Latvia next month, and then they have the 2 real tough ones in November, which is Norway and Italy.
Okay. Italy again. You seem to always play number 21.
Tour campaign in a row. Yeah, that's right. I remember covering Stephen Kenny's campaign in 2019, and we did Italy then, had them again the last time, and here they are again. And they always do end up finishing top. They actually drew nil all with Latvia, which is a bit of a shock. But they just, as you know, with the Italians, they come good at the right time. So still a fair bit to play in that, but so far so good. And they really, as Jim said afterwards, they had to get those 6 points, 2 games at home, because the tougher tests will come ahead.
Listen, I know it's only San Marino, but you have to beat what's put in front of you. In terms of the Ireland performance, how impressive were they as a unit, as a group?
Yeah, they really played to their strengths. Jim plays sort of a system 4-3-3, so it gives license to the wingers, which is Rocco Vatta and Tony Springett, to really get down the flanks. And then you had Sinclair, who is a powerhouse, as we know. You know, he's got someone you can see physically has really developed. He's playing the championship. He scored twice this year, season already. So using all those strengths, and the fact that they're missing Joe Hodge through injury, all things considered, it was quite impressive. But again, as always with the 21s, and I covered them as a freelancer for 11 years, you just have to really temper expectations, in both in terms of individual players, but also as a collective team in terms of qualification. It's very difficult. We've never qualified under-21s. They're the only team, I think, started in the FAI umbrella who haven't. Obviously the women's broke their duck there last year, so they got very close the last time, got to in the playoff, went out in penalties against Israel. So second place will guarantee a playoff, and if it's good enough, one of the 3 of the 9 actually goes directly to the finals in Slovakia, and that would be a great achievement. And also, you know, it gives players great experience in terms of going on to the senior setup.
Would you be confident of qualifying from this group and how it's shaping up? I know it's very early days.
I certainly think they'll compete as they did the last time. had a bit of a look at the Italians. Again, they're a bit like us. They've players are oscillating between the seniors and the 21. So, you know, come the senior team in Italy are, you know, not having a great time at the moment. So they may just prioritise the 21s and let them have their best players when it comes to the crunch. So, yeah, I'm a natural optimist. We do have a history, even before Stephen and Jim, of starting campaigns very well, but sort of fading towards the end. But had we dropped points, it would have been difficult. We dropped points, I think, against Luxembourg early on in the last campaign, and we managed to recover from that. But this one will probably hinge on the games against Norway and Italy.
Okay, well, one man who is crossing over between senior team and under-21s is Sinclair Armstrong, and he was chatting to RT Sport last night.
It's been a whirlwind of a few days. You know, Friday morning, you're getting told, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to play, you know, my first game with the 21s, and then next year, you know, the gaffer, Mr. Crawford, tells me, you know, you're going to the senior team. And yeah, as I said before, you know, just very emotional on that journey up to Castleknock, you know, something I've dreamed of as a kid, you know, to play with Ireland senior team since I put the jersey on as a 16-year-old. And, you know, happening, you know, 2 days ago against the Netherlands, you know, it's a dream come true.
We heard you were only too delighted to come back and help your under-21 teammates out as well tonight.
Yeah, 100%, because, you know, it's all take any minutes I can get. Well, I got 3 minutes, you know, so... when they told me, you know, would you come back, I was delighted to come back because obviously these are my boys, these are my teammates, and, you know, I was happy to contribute to the game tonight. Last season just wasn't my season, you know, I couldn't get my feet going, I couldn't get a run of games, I couldn't, you know, score any goals, you know, so obviously over that summer break, you know, I had to train as hard as I can, you know, and come back with a, you know, new mentality to, you know, go like, listen, it's every man for themselves, you know, I want to play in the championship, I want to play for QPR, and, you know, that's exactly what I'm doing, you know, 4 games in, and I have 2 goal contributions, but I know by my standards, you know, that's not enough. So, you know, I want to keep going. I want to, you know, keep playing games, keep scoring a few goals for QPR, and obviously get my senior debut now for, obviously, Republic of Ireland. Is only going to instill confidence into me, getting a goal tonight in front of Cork, you know, it's just going to instill more confidence into me, and, you know, I just want to keep going and going and going. And at the end of the day, I'm still young, you know, I'm 20 years of age. I still feel like I have a lot to give. You know, I just want to keep improving every day as myself as a footballer, and, you know, hopefully I can do that QPR with the Republic of Ireland.
So we're in the business, John, of talking up young English or young Irish strikers. My apologies, young Irish strikers. How good can Sinclair Armstrong be?
He can be very good. Yeah, just his background. He started with Tray Orchard, went to Shamrock Rovers, made his debut at 15, actually in the FAI Cup. I remember him going on trials with a few Bundesliga clubs, but he actually settled on QPR. And I spoke to a couple of people there about him just to get their impressions, and what they said was the raw material is all there, he just needs some really polishing up. And having spoken to him last week before the Turkey game, and you can hear it in his interview there, he's quite humble, he does understand where he is and what he has to do. For example, you know, he was talking about taking shots from 30 yards, mad stuff, and end up getting taken off, whereas he just has to add that level of composure to his game. You know, he's going to get chances. It's just a case whether he can finish them. But he has plenty of attributes, power, speed, aerial ability. And just, a couple of additional bits of finesse, I suppose, would make him the complete striker.
Is it a case of we'll be talking about Armstrong Ferguson up front, or is that doing Adam Eade a disservice considering he performed well against France and the Netherlands?
Yeah, it doesn't seem that long ago we were talking about Parrott and Connolly and Obafemi as well, you know, like this. If you look at the names, there's an abundance of them there. But so much can happen. Like, he's 20 and I don't want to put the markers on him, he's played in the championship, he's scored in the championship, which is half the battle, but we've just seen with players, young players, things can change. Like the manager who gave him his debut, who he said changed his life, Michael Beale, left last year. You know, he went to Rangers and he sort of had a rocky patch after that. And managerial changes, ownership changes, you know, in terms of investment can come in. External factors can have such an influence on a player's development, you know, and you look at Aaron Connolly as a prime example of that. So it's very hard to be definitive on these things, but based upon what we can see and what we can hear from him, he's got a lot going for him.
He sounds grounded. That's really most important thing. Yeah. Even small things like Mr. Crawford and they're my boy. Yeah. Like, he seems just like a likeable.
Yeah, bit of etiquette there, you know. But equally very assertive, you know, in terms of what he wants, But equally on the pitch, like last night, he had two chances within the first 10 minutes. And then he crossed for Rocco Vatta's first goal. And you could just see in him, he just wanted to get this game over and done with. He just wanted to score, do a few assists. And then he sort of came off the last 10 minutes and he basically got a standing ovation. So it'll be interesting, you know, I know we're going to talk later on about seniors in terms of where he fits in, sort of end of this campaign, going into next year's campaign with the seniors.
Okay, final question on the under-21s. We will be chatting kind of in detail, as I mentioned at the start of the show, kind of senior team management and plenty more besides. But Mr. Crawford, as Sinclair refers to him as, how highly regarded is Jim Crawford as a manager internally within the FAI, do you think?
Very highly. And not just within the FAI, because I know he was linked with the Bohemians position there. You know, and that came up after Keith Long. But I think from speaking to Jim and knowing him, you know, over the years, even when he's under radio manager, he probably thrives in a developmental role. He likes working with young players. He gets the best out of them. I think his big ambition would be to end that famine of getting a qualification, which could never be taken away from him. He did work under Stephen Kenny as his assistant in 2019. So he would have, you know, and Keith Andrews was there at the time. So it was probably wasn't surprising that he got the job straight away when those two went up to the seniors in 2020. So, you know, good manager, knows the game inside out, very good coach. Overall, a lot going for him and highly regarded. And that's why he got his new contract.
Okay. And good at developing players as well. Like, this isn't a case of just it's a pathway to the senior job or anything. He's entirely focused on the development of young Irish players, which is just brilliant to see.
Yeah, optimising whatever ability's there. It doesn't mean they're all going to play in the Premier League, but, you know, he's getting the best out of what's there. And, you know, bear in mind, international management is quite difficult to do that. As we know, most of the development is done at club level. But it seems the time that they spend with Jim, you know, certainly contributes to that. And we've seen plenty of examples of that. And I think we'll see more in this campaign.
And of course, Jim Crawford, the only player to stick with Shells in 06 when they hit rock bottom. So one of the good guys, John Fallon.
How could you forget?
One of the good guys. Yeah, yeah. Okay, from association football to rugby football.
Game on.
Rugby.
But first up is rugby. Michael Corcoran joins me now. Michael, we are edging closer to the Tongan test on Saturday after Ireland's first victory of the Rugby World Cup. Keith Earls and Mick Carney were up in media duty today. What is the news in terms of injuries?
It's pretty positive news regarding Jack Conan, because he's been troubled by foot injury since the warm-up match against Italy and hasn't done any on-field training over the last while. So he's been training in the gym, training on his own, doing some kind of individual exercises with the physios and everything like that. And the good news is that he took part in a pretty light session, it must be said, early this morning in the rain, in the training facility that they use. So there's positivity there around that. So assuming that he doesn't have any adverse reaction, that will be stepped up over the next while. He's not going to be available this week, but the whole idea would be that, you know, if everything goes according to plan, you know, because obviously there's a big squad of 33 people there, you know, those who are not involved this weekend will have their own sort of individualised training sessions as the week goes on. The plan is that he will train in full next week with a view to him potentially being available to play South Africa up in Paris.
Just final one on Conan. Is there any fear, even in your opinion, that going in cold to the South Africa match might be a concern for Irish management?
I would say it'll be a concern, yes. But then we were all concerned that Johnny Sexton went in cold against Romania last week and hadn't played a match for over 6 months. Just, you know, Shane, the situation with the way the squad and the management train and the intensity in which they train, they're replicating match conditions all of the time in terms of what they're trying to do. So, it would be a concern that he's not match sharp, but he is match sharp-ish, if you understand the difference, or a subtle difference kind of between the two. But they certainly will want him 100% in terms of his fitness. So, I mean, they wouldn't be suggesting that he's this far down the road unless they were really happy that he was going to be pretty much okay for the game next week, not this week.
And more good news perhaps for this week, Irish front rowers in terms of injury news. Everyone trained besides Jack Conan, basically.
Exactly. And I mean, there's, you know, Dave Kilcoyne has trained all week. Dan Sheehan has trained all week as well. And, you know, we must pay tribute really to the medical staff and the people who are in the background, you know, the physios, doctors, people like that. I mean, they're working tirelessly, practically 24 hours a day. I mean, at one stage we thought when Dan Sheehan got injured a couple of weeks back, we thought he'd be out until the knockout stages. If Ireland made it that far, and the fact that he, you know, potentially is available for the game this weekend, and is back training full time and at full tilt with everybody taking contact, it says a lot about the medical staff, but it also says a lot about the individuals concerned that they've put in a huge effort to get onto the training pitch.
So plenty of positivity looking ahead to Saturday. It's an interesting one because I know so many people were talking up the so-called second-tier nations, the Pacific Island teams. I know Fiji lost on the opening weekend. But in terms of this Tongan team and the laxing in the eligibility rules, is this the strongest Tonga team that has competed at a World Cup?
I would say 100% yes. I mean, they're ranked number 15 in the world. I mean, if you look at, you know, potentially a Tongan team with the likes of Charles Pietau or Malachi Fekitoa, Peter Aki, in it. If I called out those first three names and I said they were in the New Zealand team, you'd say, oh, that's the start of a strong New Zealand team. Mm. Well, because of the eligibility situation now, that is the start of a very strong Tongan team. That's the reality too. So, they haven't been this strong before. The one difficulty for them is this is their first game of the Rugby World Cup, so they'll be going to a kind of slightly cold. And I think that may, Andy Farrell, in terms of selecting an Ireland team, might have that sort of at the back of his mind. But Tonga will be very, very strong. Totai Kefu is their head coach, who played with Australia for a period of time. And they're potentially very, very dangerous. And it's a game that Ireland certainly can't take their eye off, really, in terms of looking beyond this weekend to the game everybody is talking about the weekend after.
Obviously, it's a step up from the Romania match.
100% it is.
In terms of a test, what is the biggest obstacle to overcome against Tonga?
It's going to be a hugely physical test, and the Ireland backs particularly will be under enormous pressure, even with some of the players that I've mentioned already, in terms of defence. You know, the Romanians had a couple of Tongans in their team last weekend in Bordeaux, but they didn't really they weren't allowed, cause too many difficulties. This will be a huge step up, really, in terms of, and I'm not just talking it up for the sake of talking it up, you know, I mean, this will be a huge step up in terms of from last week. Physicality will be enormous. They may be suspect, the Tongans that would be, we'll say, for example, in terms of a scrum or a line-out, but in terms of the rest of the work around the pitch, Ireland have to be on their toes, really, to be fair about it, because this is going to be... we can't see a repeat of the soft try they gave away at the start of the game last week. We can't see that at all this coming weekend.
So Andy Farrell's naming his team tomorrow?
Yeah.
So it's going to be a physical challenge. Should Johnny Sexton start?
I don't know. I kind of change my mind every few hours in relation to this one. He tends not to go for wholesale changes. He tends to be kind of subtle and discreet in the way he does it. Andy Farrell, I'm talking about now. So you could very well see, you know, some of the people involved in the bench last week might start this week. You know, then you have people like, say, Craig Casey, who wasn't involved, could be involved this week. That's the dilemma. I thought my reading of the situation regarding Johnny Sexton was the fact that he played against Romania for maybe longer than a lot of people did last weekend might very well indicate that he's not going to be involved this weekend. You know, because I think most people, even when David Humphreys was doing the match with me, he was suggesting that maybe Sexton would be taken off, you know, 10 minutes into the second half. We know that didn't happen. But the potential is there for, the longer you're on the pitch, the potential is there for injury. And obviously nobody wants that ahead of the game next week. But then again, you have to marry that with the fact that, you know, Johnny Sexton doesn't have too many other opportunities to play for Ireland before he retires. But that's kind of to one side for now. This team aren't there on a kind of farewell tour. This is a team and a squad that want to win the Rugby World Cup, so they will pick the best team from their point of view to win the match against Tonga. Now, whether that includes Johnny Sexton or not, I genuinely have no idea, to be fair.
Well, one man who isn't taking Tonga lightly and agrees with your sentiments is Keith Earls.
Yeah, you know, it's like all the Ireland teams, really. You know, it's going to be a really physical contest. You know, we're going to have to be switched on in defence. Some really incredibly good athletes. You know, so I've obviously played with Mala for a season in Munster. I know what he can do. I've obviously played against Charles Pietau in his time in Ulster. So we know we have to be on it, or else we'll get punished.
They certainly will have to be on it. Live commentary of Tonga is on RTE Radio 1 this weekend. Broader picture then with the Rugby World Cup. I know you were at the Ireland match against Romania, Michael, and World Rugby today has apologised to supporters over the organisation around the game against Romania in Bordeaux last Saturday. Ireland fans faced long delays getting into the Stade de Bordeaux, where many reported water was unavailable despite searing temperatures. Problems with trams to the ground also delayed their arrival. It left hundreds of seats empty at kickoff, something that also happened at the England-Argentina game in Marseille later that day. Did you notice any issues when you were there?
Well, I got to the ground pretty early, but I was aware of the fact from talking to people even during the course of this week that there was an issue at one of the trams, that it came off one of the tracks. And the reason it did that is because there was no supervision of the numbers of people getting on. The stadium is on the outside, the outskirts of Bordeaux, and the tram is exactly a carbon copy of the Lewis. So you have exactly the same type carriages and that type of thing. And there were people literally wedging themselves into it, trying to get to the stadium. I believe air conditioning was a bit of a problem there as well, because there was no windows you could open or anything like that. So I think that the derailment of one of the trams led to a backlog then, in terms of, you know, people trying to get to the stadium and everything. I was there pretty early, I must admit, but I did speak to one member of the media who came up pretty close to kickoff, and he said to me, a lot of people are going to miss the start of this match. He said there are thousands of people outside with tickets trying to get in. Now, whether that was a ticketing issue or a scanning issue with tickets, or it was a knock-on effect because of the tram situation, I'm not entirely sure, to be fair about it. I will say, you know, you mentioned there about the people complaining about the lack of water. I can 100% categorically tell you that, yes, there was a lack of water, even for those of us who are working in the media section. Rather than providing water, you had to bring your own water bottle, which you filled. That was great, but somebody had to tell you in the first place that you needed to bring a water bottle. Mm. So, I mean, I was given, those sort of takeaway cups that you use for an espresso, type thing?
Yeah, the small ones.
Yeah. I was given one of those with water in it, and I was told that had to do me till halftime.
This could possibly be a huge problem for World Rugby going forward with this World Cup. Like, I know it's we see an issue with the Champions League in France. France are going to be holding an Olympics next year as well. So something isn't clicking, and World Rugby might bear the brunt of it.
Well, they're in a situation where, you know, I'm not sure it's entirely the fault of World Rugby, to be fair to them about it. You know, you look back to what happened in the Champions League. You look back to, you know, what happened last weekend, not just in Bordeaux, but in Marseille. There was problems there as well in terms of people getting into the ground. That's an organisational problem. Yet we're talking about an organisation here who could organise the most ludicrously lopsided draw 1,000 days out from the very first match. They could do that no problem, but they couldn't do a basic thing like provide you with a bottle of water on the day of a match, or scan tickets in, or get people in on time, basically. So the finger will point at World Rugby, but I think it's a France organisation problem is what the issue is here.
Well, one good bit of news is that Rugby World Cup organisers have bowed to pressure and this morning announced plans to re-record the pre-match national anthems after they faced widespread criticism across the tournament's opening weekend. Officials also said the new versions would be subject to approval from the competing nations. Did this irk you as much as social media, Michael?
No. I was too in the zone at that stage, to be fair about it. In fact, I hadn't even, you know, to be perfectly fair about it, I hadn't even noticed how good or bad they were. I rarely do. That's the reality about it. I'm kind of looking at my watch in the countdown to kickoff, going, you know, have we much more of this left so that we can get on with the match, basically. That's what I tend
You're
to
not one for the pre-match rituals.
Well, I do. I love Le Marseillaise. I love that. I love the Italian anthem. Mm. I love God Defend New Zealand. I like those type anthems, really, that kind of get the crowds going. But certainly the crowds weren't going in a situation last weekend, certainly in the matches that I saw, like they normally would, you know. So if it's to be re-recorded and it helps everybody rather than having puzzled looks on people's faces, well, that's fair enough.
Can only be a good thing. I want to end our conversation the way we started, talking about Ireland, and I have a clip here to actually play for you, because it emphasises, I suppose, the good atmosphere within the Irish camp.
Well, as I said before, there's a bit of a dictatorship going on in camp at the moment. We have three lads that call themselves the sheriffs. They're in charge of any misdemeanours or any fines that need to be taking place within the camp. And unfortunately, I turned up a couple of seconds late for a meeting, and they decided to fine me. And I had to spin the wheel of fortune, and I landed on number ones to and from training, so hence the suit. But it fell on media day, so everyone gets to see me in a nice suit, so how bad? it was a couple of seconds, all right, yeah. There's a cut-off time, and if you're late, you're late, and which is fair enough. So yeah, I'm not the only one who's spun, but yeah, you got to see what one of the punishments is. James Ryan, Jack Conan, and Dave Kilcoyne.
James Ryan, Dave Kilcoyne, and Jack Conan. Banter merchants.
Dangerous men, I'll tell you. I know that myself. Dangerous men. But I wouldn't be worried about Tadhg Byrne there, because the fitness of Tadhg Byrne last week to play 80-odd minutes with a scrum cap on in 36 degrees and to run three quarters of the length of the pitch to support Mac Hansen and sprint clear and score a try under the post. I mean, that says a lot about his fitness, to be fair about it. So,
and he'd be able to do it in a double-breasted suit, I'd say.
Wearing an old suit, like, is a no, no, might be a problem for me, but it certainly isn't for Tadhg Byrne or the rest of them.
Okay, to wrap up, Michael, Ireland are going to beat Tonga, but it'll be a bit closer than a lot of people will suspect.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a great fella for kind of hanging my hat on scores or anything like that, but I think it'll be closer. But I think Ireland will improve, and there are areas that probably will. Well, there are areas that will need to improve on as well. But I think Ireland to win, a bonus point would be fantastic, and fingers crossed that nobody gets injured.
Here's hoping. Michael Corcoran, gentlemen, as always, thank you very much.
Game on.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On, and we are continuing our soccer chat in the company of John Fallon, football correspondent with the Irish Examiner. John, there is a media briefing tomorrow, some might say a long overdue media briefing, with FAI CEO Jonathan Hill and Director of Football Mark Canham. So, nice and broad question for you. What are we expecting from it tomorrow?
Yeah, it's like a town hall meeting at this stage, really, because there's so much to talk about. Yeah, just to give you some context for this, obviously Vera Powell's contract was coming towards the end as we went to the World Cup, and there was obviously allegations hanging over from America, which she strenuously denied. So we had asked to speak with Jonathan Hill where we were in Australia, and he'd actually mentioned that to a couple of journalists the day he was in the Dáil when football was on the agenda. So there was an expectation that he would speak to us, and we put a request in, but that didn't materialise because we were told that there was going to be an ongoing review or a collateral review of the performance in the World Cup, but also stretching back to the start of the campaign. So that was the excuse given. You know, lots of corporate speak about processes and reviews and due diligence and all that. So we're now back from the World Cup. It took 3 weeks, as we know, to have that board meeting where they dispense with Vera. I think it would have been opportune maybe after that meeting, straight after the meeting. I know we were out there for 6 hours just to give us a briefing on the reasons behind it and some context. That didn't happen, and so there was a vacuum thereafter, and into that vacuum came Vera herself, becoming the storm with our interview with Tony O'Donoghue. And that has brought up several issues, several things which I don't think people were aware of or maybe had suspected
So is this an opportunity then for the FAI to kind of give their point of view? I can understand there were journalists out with it there, but perhaps in the FAI's defence, they didn't want to give a knee-jerk reaction or kind of speak out of turn, that they did have to put in a process and all of this kind of business speak. But in terms of seeing actually what went wrong or what went right and to review it as a whole.
Yeah, we're sort of talking about two different tranches. We're talking about the time between the end of the World Cup and them letting her go, say it was 3 weeks, and then we've had the period since. Whereas I think they could have dealt with it maybe the night that Vera was let go or even the next morning. Instead, what has happened then, we've gone into the men's window. That hasn't gone well, and therefore pressure has come on the men's manager. And that's going to lead all roads to Abbottstown tomorrow morning, where both of those topics are going to be raised. Now, to deal with the first one, which is obviously the Vera Powell issue, the way it's going to be addressed in the morning at 10:30 is, which is fairly unprecedented, Jonathan Hill, we believe, is going to give an opening address in which we believe he's probably going to refute or give a different take on some of the allegations that are claims that Vera made in that interview, in terms of what she said about being basically her space being encroached and interference and feeling undermined, and basically that she knew even when she was dancing on the stage that night in O'Connell Street that her job was gone. So why wasn't it handled properly? As she said, if they didn't want her, even before the World Cup, she said she probably would have taken it there and then if there was anything to do with the historical allegations, which again, we don't know. That's probably going to come out tomorrow. What exactly were the reasons for that? I think the FAI will have to be very careful because, you know, the existence of player power, you know, to use that phrase has been floating around as the allegations in the background, because you certainly can't say her performance, her record, warranted being let go. Okay, we didn't win a match at the World Cup. She made some bad decisions in terms of selection and tactics, but we didn't disgrace ourselves, so I don't think on that tournament alone you could say that she deserved to be let go. What the FAI did say or intimate was that basically she wasn't the type of manager which fitted in with their philosophy.
What is their philosophy?
That's what we have to hear from. You know, I thought philosophy was developing players and qualifying and getting the tournaments on a regular basis. So, again, the addition of Mark Canham to the press conference tomorrow is curious in that regard, because Mark has been with the association since June 2022 and he hasn't done any formal media conferences. And this is despite the fact that when he took over that role, which was sort of renamed from Rue Doctor's High Performance Director's role, you looked at the remit and basically it was everything under the football heading, you know, from the elite side right down to grassroots. And I understand there's a bedding in period and he's moving to a new country and all, but to leave it this long, 15, 16 months, and now to be put into a situation tomorrow, which is very much firefighting, again, just smacks of bad management. If the FAI are starting on the back foot, which they probably will be tomorrow, how can you come out and set out your philosophy in that context? That's not the place to do it or the setting to do it. So again, it's just one of those questions, but there's so much detail, there's so much more specifics around it that we might even get into that.
Okay, well, it is going to be interesting to see how the time is managed anyway. But listen, Vera Powell is no longer an employee of the FAI. Eileen Gleeson is the interim manager in charge of the women's national team. They have matches against Northern Ireland and Hungary coming up at the end of this month in 10 days' time. Northern Ireland at Lansdowne Road before Hungary in Budapest. News today, Colin Healy, Emma Byrne have been added to the coaching ticket, as has FAI High Performance National Coach Educator Richie Fitzgibbon, who holds a UEFA A goalkeeping licence and has worked with several underage international teams. So good to see two goalkeepers on the coaching ticket, speaking with my union hat on. But on a serious note, Eileen Gleeson, interim manager, might that change to Eileen Gleeson, permanent manager?
I wouldn't rule it out categorically. Just on today's appointments, I think it's great to see Emma Byrne in there. And it's not as a goalkeeping coach as many people had anticipated. Emma will make her presence felt, you can be sure of that. As we've seen her, you know, talking your own punditry during the World Cup. But looking ahead, Eileen is a UEFA Pro licence licence holder. She managed in the Women's National League with Piemont, very successfully in DLR Waves. She worked at Glasgow City in a standalone role, which was after assistant Vera Powell. So she has pedigree in terms of her managerial background. She's going into now a campaign, which is the first ever women's UEFA Nations League campaign. And the way this, the rankings fell is that basically we're the top seed in this group. So we have got, as you mentioned, we've got Northern Ireland, Hungary, and then Albania. Three teams who we would be expected to beat, okay, and some of them very comfortably. So if you've got an interim manager in there who has a good chance of winning four, five, even six games, when on the other side of it there's no serious candidate really sticking out at the moment for that role, I think it's possessions on intents of the law there. I'm not saying that she's going to take it, because she does have a broad role in terms of other aspects of the women's game in Ireland, but you know, certainly seems to have the respect of the players. She worked with a lot of them in Ireland, and again, very knowledgeable. So we don't know what profile of manager the FEI are looking for, or Mark Cannon was looking for. He's going to be leading the chase. But
who else would be in the running, do you suspect?
Getting individual names is very difficult, particularly around the Irish market, because, you know, again, UEFA pro licence holders, there's very few. I think Sue Ronan and Laura Heffernan's on the course at the moment, so that's a minimum requirement. If you just for now, without being too patriotic about it, if you look at Irish people around the game, you've got Alan Mahon, who was assistant manager at Manchester City and has been for a number of years with a few different managers. I think he'd like a stab at it. And then you have the international circuit. You have managers that do work with different women's teams, and we've seen that in the World Cup. I know Randy Waldrum has been mentioned. Is that
he's been mentioned in a Rafa Benitez has been linked with the men's job?
Yes, it's a bit of razzmatazz to it, I think. I don't know whether Randy put himself in the frame there, but he is sort of in that ilk of what I'm just talking about. Someone who manages different teams, goes in, does a job, and moves on. So in summation, there isn't a standout candidate that's there that's ready to go in. So these matches are coming up quick. We play that match in Lansdowne, can't forget that. That's a very significant landmark for the women's game, first time in Lansdowne Road, Aviva Stadium, and the FEI would much prefer to have less controversy in the run up to that and be out selling tickets to ensure that you do have a healthy turnout, because this really should have happened a year or two ago.
Okay, well, it will be interesting to see what happens in terms of the women's national team job. Vera Powell, of course, out of a job. And for the men's national team, Stephen Kenny is still in a job. And I suspect a lot of the questions towards the FEI is going to be a case of, is Stephen seeing out his contract for the rest of the campaign? And that will have to be handled a lot more delicately, considering he is still in charge of the men's national team, and he will be for the end of his contract. That's, nothing has changed in that regard.
Yeah, they're two very different cases. Vera is no longer an FEI employee. Stephen is. And I suspect they'll be very circumspect on his situation tomorrow. And we'll probably glean more out of what's not said when it comes to Stephen, because the obvious questions are going to be, do the FEI have full confidence in Stephen? I don't know whether they can, you know, they can declare that. Can they say with certainty that he's going to be in charge for the October doubleheader against Greece and Gibraltar? Again, it's I'd be surprised if we get something definitive on that. But what we do know when it comes to the men's manager is, and this is from Stephen himself, that he did ask to be judged on this Euro 2024 campaign. And without being mathematically out of it, I think in reality we are, after losing four out of the five games. And it's probably, you know, at this stage that we're, you know, that we're not even assured of third place, that unless we beat Greece, that's going to be an uphill task. So that's sort of the background to it. And I think most of the damage that was done on Stephen in this campaign was in Athens, you know, back in June. Not just in terms of the result, but just the overall match. I was there myself that night. It could easily be in 4 or 5-1 for Greece, and, you know, some very strange selection calls, and then just the in-game coaching management was very suspect as well. And I think, you know, a lot of people that would have been backing Stephen, maybe within the FEI hierarchy, would have probably would have changed a bit from that night. And also, we don't forget, we played Gibraltar a few days later, and we were nil all at half time. you know, and he took Nathan Collins off at half time, which was glaringly obvious. We didn't need four defenders. So from what I can make out, a lot of the discussion on Stephen's job security, let's call it, was discussed straight after that game. And the view, using various criteria, primarily the fact that the feel-good factor was around for the Women's World Cup, that it wouldn't be time to part ways and that they would give him this window, as difficult as these matches were away to France and Holland at home, that they would be allowed maybe in the off chance that we'd get a point here or there. But you know, you've seen the match yourself. I was at them, like, the best team won on both nights, and I think that's probably applied the last rites to it.
Is Irish football in a better place now than it was when Stephen Kenny took over?
Well, it depends what criteria you use, Shane, because if you were to go by the FIFA rankings, which is the metrics that is used, you know, in terms of draws and seedings and so on, absolutely not. Because when Stephen took over, I think in April 2020, we were 34. We were 53 going into this window, and just doing some basic maths today, I think we're looking at going into 55 when the new totals are calculated, and that's a plummet, you know, like that's 21 places, and that has consequences in terms of our seeding. That we, you know, how do we get here, I suppose, is the question. You know, like, going back to Stephen's first campaign, the Nations League campaign, if we had beaten Bulgaria at home in that final game, we would have been a second seed. Instead, we were a third seed and we get drawn against Portugal and Serbia. We finished third again in that campaign. We went to the Nations League campaign, which Stephen targets top spot in, which would have brought us into the second seeding and also guaranteed us a playoff to the Nations League.
Mm.
We finished third again. So we went to the draw in Frankfurt last October as third seed, and at that stage it's a lottery, and we did very badly out of that lottery in that we got two really good teams. It was actually Netherlands who were actually the top seed. France didn't have a great Nations League campaign. So this is a cumulative effect, unfortunately, you know, from the demise that has gone on, that we end up playing these teams. But again, I think the acid test wasn't the games against them, it was Greece, where you have to beat the teams below you. And if you look at managers previously, that's what they did. You know, they beat the teams below them, and they might have nicked a point here and there, or in Martin O'Neill's case, he beat Germany at home. We're not getting either of those. And, you know, from an FEI perspective, you know, in economic terms, you know where the FEI's financial position is. It's not as bad as it was, but their strategy document did map out the fact that their objective was to qualify for every second tournament, which is effectively the Euros. So our last qualification was in 2016.
Mm.
And we're now not going to be at the Euros. Okay, and then we're going towards the World Cup in 2026, which is going to be even more difficult to qualify. So you're going a decade without a tournament. And the tournament for nations, for countries, for associations is big money, mm. big bonuses. It's big increments in terms of sponsors, and we know the FEI don't have a main sponsor for their men's team. So this really matters. And you have to sort of, as Roy Barrett says, take the emotion out of it sometimes. As much as I think we all did, we're all League of Ireland fans. Stephen was a graduate of the League of Ireland. We wanted him to do well. Allowances were made for a lot of the blips along the way. But by his own admission, this was the one that he had to deliver on, and he hasn't. Mm. And that has reached a situation where I think the FEI have lost faith in him. And we're reaching this point now where we had this very strange juncture where his contract runs up to end of our involvement in the Euros, which is probably going to be November, given the Nations League is so bleak. But the FEI have a dilemma. You know, what do they do? Their option A is to go out tomorrow or the day after and say, thanks, Stephen, we're relieving your duties and we're going to pay you per contract. Option B is leave him where he is. Or option C is... it's probably a hybrid. It's actually, you know, just to have a caretaker manager in there. But to leave him in the position going into October where they're selling tickets for a Greece game, and a manager who is basically a dead man walking, Just has all sorts of repercussions, you know, particularly for the players. If you're in the dressing room and you're looking at this manager who you know is not going to be there, where's the motivation to do well? And I think it would be fairly unprecedented for the FAI to let this rumble on and just keep him there because they haven't either got faith in a caretaker management team or they're not confident that they will have a successor lined up in time.
Well, it will be interesting to see. I suppose the caveat to that is that Stephen has blooded through a lot of young players, and hopefully that will stand to us in the future, and perhaps that the standard of players isn't there to be beating the Greases and to be qualifying for major tournaments, but decisions to be made for the FAI. I know Lee Carsey is a strong candidate for the job, and we'll be interested to see how that one plays out. John, I did want to ask you about GDPR concerns within the FAI. Another headache for them, but unfortunately, time is against us. Coleman O'Sullivan has that story on the RT Sport or on the RT website if you do want to read more on that, because it is a developing story. But for now, we're going to take a short break. John Fallon of the Irish Examiner, thank you very much for popping into the studio, because it was really well fleshed out conversation there. We're going to be chatting American football next.
Game on.
Eye on America.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On, as we have our eye on America. Big news in the NFL. So we bumped Jeff Shepherd up from a Thursday to a Wednesday, Shep, because there is heartbreaking news this week for fans of the Jets. Before I get your thoughts on the big talking point, we can listen to some heartbreaking audio for Jets fans on the Aaron Rodgers injury.
Projection breaks down and time runs out. Down goes Rodgers and the sack for Leonard Floyd. New this year, and after spending 3 years with the Rams, the former first-round pick of the Bears, and now Rodgers sits down. A loss of 10 on the play, and hopefully the Jets are thinking that's the only loss on that play. See what happened at the end of it.
Take a look here at the very end, and it's hard to see.
He's coming out of the game. And that means that a few plays into game one, Zach Wilson, the former number two overall pick from BYU, who's made 22 starts in the NFL, has thrown 15 touchdowns, 18 picks.
So, Jeff Shepherd, it looked like an innocuous blow, but it was far from it.
No, that's right, Shane. I mean, look, he gets sacked, and then he goes down, and you're thinking, okay, all right, well, maybe he tweaked an ankle or did something, and, you know, then he has to get helped off. And then all of a sudden, he goes into the tent, and then the next thing is he's getting on a cart to be wheeled back to the locker room, and you're going, okay, this isn't just an ankle injury. This is going to be something worse. And it turns out Aaron Rodgers tore his Achilles tendon. And so he will be out this season. He's 39 years old. He's, you know, he got four plays. Shane, you are a newly admitted new Jets fan over the last, 15 months. And so, you've been paying more attention to this, I know, than you ever have in recent years. And so he was the new face of the franchise. They were building everything around him. I mean, they felt like quarterback was the missing piece from last season, and they felt like they had got the best one that was available. And, they had big plans this season. And in four plays, it's all gone. It's just a stunning turn of events. And you heard Joe Buck say, the play-by-play announcer, that they turned to Zach Wilson, former number two overall pick, really struggled, though, in his starts. But we'll give Zach Wilson credit. He put them in position to win the other night. They got into overtime and then won on a punt return. But again, I mean, the giant takeaway is, yes, they did. I believe it was summed up best by saying they won the battle but lost the war, I think is the best way to look at that.
Yeah, I think all the headlines were Super Bowl or bust for the Jets. That's why I was gone, but it seems to be bust. Listen, do I have any reasons to be optimistic with Zach Wilson and perhaps some miracle for the Jets?
So, look, I mean, their defense is very good. I mean, I don't know if you watched the replay at any point on Tuesday or anybody, over there stayed up late enough to watch the game. Their defense was phenomenal. They've got great running backs. They've got good receivers. Again, the piece that was missing really for them was the quarterback. I think they got a tremendous amount of confidence and a boost from Zach Wilson, by him having the performance that he did. But he's proven over and over again he hasn't really been up to snuff to be a top-tier NFL quarterback or even a mid-level NFL quarterback, which was why I think the plan over the next couple of years, Shane, was Aaron Rodgers was basically going to kind of tutor him and get him to be in a position to take this over in a couple of seasons and go from there. And that's all been fast-tracked right now. They're in a pretty tough division. The Dolphins are very good. The Patriots are probably so-so. And then you've got the Bills, who they just beat, but I think are going to be better the rest of the season than they were the other night. So it's going to be difficult for them to make the playoffs. Now, I'm not saying it can't be done. They stole a huge victory this week, but Zach Wilson will have to play much better than he has in the past for them to be in the playoff hunt.
Okay, final one for you, Shep. Daniel Whelan, first Irishman since the 80s to play in the NFL. Is he going to be a big-time player, major star, or how will his season transpire, do you feel?
I mean, look, he had an unbelievable first week as a punter, okay? So you know, again, Shane, let's talk about this. The punting position, it's really good if you don't know the name of your punter, and if he never plays in the game, that means your offense is kicking butt. Well, let me tell you something. The Packers scored 38 points the other night. I mean, their offense was fantastic. They beat the Bears by 18 points. But Whelan had 5 punts. He averaged almost 50 yards a punt, and he had a long of 68. Let me tell you something. If that's what he's going to do, he's going to be in the NFL for the next 25 years. I mean, he's just, you know, he will be the number one punter in football if he keeps that up. So he had a phenomenal day on top of the Packers having an awesome offensive day as well.
Brilliant. On that positive note, we'll leave it there. Jeff Shepherd, gentlemen, as always, thank you very much. Thank you to Andrew O'Connor, who produced this evening's show. Andrew McDermott was our BCO. Big thanks to you for listening. Bette de Silva is up next on 2FM, so do stay tuned here on 2FM. We're going to check in with the news desk after a short outbreak from all of the Game On team. It is bye for now.